You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be looking at the founder of EasyJet's plans to expand his business into Africa. Also ahead in the next 60 minutes, it's been called the greatest form of government ever devised. We'll be discussing democracy with the author of a new book on the subject. Also coming up on the show that goes behind the scenes here at Monocle, we'll push the microphone and the pen to one side as we talk television. And we'll also be rifling through the magazine archives here as we look at a stack of issues from year four. All that plus some great music too. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. So lots and lots to back in into the next 60 minutes. Before all that, though, let's get the latest headlines from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Simultaneous early morning attacks on mostly Shiite targets across Iraq killed at least 60 people and wounded dozens today in one of the bloodiest days of violence since US troops pulled out in mid-December. The violence breaks weeks of relative calm as Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and Sunni leaders have sought to resolve a political crisis that threatened to unravel their power-sharing agreement following the US withdrawal. International leaders discussed reforms intended to end Somalia's conflict and eradicate militant and pirate groups seen as a growing menace to world security. Addressing a conference today in London aimed at energising attempts to end more than 20 years of anarchy, the Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi said the solution was political.
The Somali crisis is first and foremost a political crisis, and it can only be resolved by political means through the reconstitution and renewal of the Somali state.
Also at the conference, US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said any obstruction by members of the Transitional Federal Government, or TFG, wouldn't be tolerated.
We will encourage the international community to impose further sanctions, including travel bans and asset freezes, on people inside and outside the TFG who seek to undermine Somalia's peace and security or to delay or even prevent the political transition.
Hillary Clinton and Pakistan's Foreign Minister Hina Rabbani Kaur held talks on the sidelines of the conference on Somalia. Relations between Pakistan and the US have been all but frozen since a cross-border attack by US troops from Afghanistan in which 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed. Clinton is expected to seek a restart of diplomacy with Islamabad, particularly a re-engagement of counter-terrorism efforts. Afghanistan wants NATO to put on public trial those who burned copies of the Quran at a NATO base, President Hamid Karzai's office said today, after a third day of bloody protests over the incident. It said NATO had agreed to a trial, but that could not be immediately confirmed. Karzai had earlier accused a US officer of ignorantly burning copies of the Quran in an incident that has deepened anti-Western sentiment in a country NATO is trying to destabilise before foreign combat troops leave by the end of 2014. Syrian tanks pushed into a rebel stronghold in the battered city of Homs today, and UN investigators accused President Assad's government of crimes against humanity. The plight of Homs and other embattled towns will dominate the Friends of Syria talks in Tunis tomorrow, involving the United States, European and Arab countries, Turkey and other nations, demanding that Assad halt the bloodshed and relinquish power. Russia and China, which have jointly vetoed two UN Security Council resolutions on Syria, say they will stay away. The meeting will call on Syria to implement an immediate ceasefire to give aid groups access to areas worst hit by the violence. The Italian Deputy Foreign Minister Staffan de Mistura has expressed grief over the death of two Indian fishermen who were allegedly gunned down by two crew of an Italian ship. India had said the two seamen killed the two Indian fishermen as they mistook them for pirates off the coast of the southern state of Kerala and wants to try them under Indian law. Italy said the accused were shooting into the water and should be tried under Italian law as they were sailing in international waters at the time when the incident occurred. Mr. Mistura was in Kerala today.
These were fishermen. These were not terrorists. These were fishermen and the Indian fishermen, poor fishermen, who died, two of them, in a terrible incident.
Finally, the world's oldest alligator held in captivity is recovering at his home in Belgrade Zoo in Serbia after undergoing surgery. Muža, whose exact age isn't known but is thought to be over 75 years old, was diagnosed with gangrene in his foot, which had to be amputated. He's been living alone in the zoo since the 1960s, when a female alligator he shared his enclosure with died. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Sounds absolutely devastating, Nick. How sad.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Do you have a moment to go through the Australian papers with us?
Well, I can. I haven't seen them.
No, neither have I. Let's have a look. Just checking what's happening in the on the other side of the world from where we are broadcasting at this precise moment. We have the latest pages coming in from The Age in the Melbourne paper. Obviously, the fight between Gillard and Rudd is taking centre stage, as one would predict, and it is getting incredibly personal. I mean, it says it's only 24, 48 hours since Kevin Rudd stood down as Foreign Minister, isn't that right, Nick?
Yeah, we had this yesterday, actually, and there was a fine cartoon of the orange-haired...
Ms Gillard.
Ms Gillard, not Rudd, he hasn't got any hair at all, like me. Look, saying how happy she was, that, you know, she was quite happy with Rudd as long as he was on the other side of the world.
Yes, which
and
is obviously...
another cartoon today. I'm looking towards the future, she says. What does he say?
I'm looking towards the future.
And what's the bottom line?
We're looking towards the future. It's absolutely shocking. I think that the whole of the front page of The Age has been devoted to the personal nature of this fight now. That is, this has got very, very little to do with policies. And in the first column, you can see Ms Gillard has opened up on the faults of the Rudd administration, saying he has difficult and chaotic work patterns. I mean, this is no reason to fail or to be dismissed as the leader of a party. And it's been highlighted the fact that this is possibly playing into the Liberal Party's hands, that because obviously this is a party that looks like it's imploding.
Absolutely. Well, the New Zealand Herald, God bless them, I mean, they're on the other side of the world. They seem to be a bit behind the times. I mean, their chosen lead story covering the whole of the front page is the fat list, 49 foods to avoid.
It's astonishing that it has taken New Zealand this long to work out that various things are...
Top of the blacklist, alcoholic drinks, biscuits, butter, lard, dripping or fat. God, that's a long time.
I know, it's news to me that lard, pies, ice cream...
Didn't know that,
and
did
quiches.
You? Were they fattening? I never realised.
And something that's quite astonished me, which is regular luncheon sausage. Do you know what regular luncheon sausage is, Nick?
Well, spam, I suppose. They're still on spam down
there. What's irregular luncheon sausage?
And the alternative, top of the list, is water.
Oh, well, that's wonderful.
About that? Well,
that's
now
wonderful.
We know.
Oh, thank you, New Zealand Herald. I'd got it wrong for all my days on with this. They were also helped by this incredibly smiley, flat-stomached woman who's eating something non-identifiable from a bowl. I'm assuming it is low-fat natural yogurt to correspond with the happiness. It could be rich cream, for all we know. The girl could be tucking into a panna cotta.
So.
It could be lard.
Yes, she's been photo-brushed, whatever you call it.
Oh, bless her. Bless her. Thank you very much indeed, Nick. So, the New Zealand Herald keeping us up to date with the 49 foods to avoid, ladies and gentlemen. Coming up in a moment, we'll be discussing plans to take over the skies in Africa. But before that, let's get the latest weather report with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
Spring-like weather across far western Europe. Thursdays and Fridays temperatures 15 to 17 degrees in the UK and the west of France. Most of Europe, however, not quite as mild, but it's not cold either. Only in Moscow is it just about cold enough for some snow. And the best weather in Europe will be in Iberia end of the week. Pleasantly warm and sunny, and it'll stay like it through the weekend as well. So here's Friday's city outlook. In London, 15 degrees. More sunshine. Paris is at 14. Partly cloudy here. Stockholm, 7 degrees and sunny. In Athens, 17 Celsius with sunny skies as well. North America now. In the eastern half of the US, a mild and rather cloudy Thursday with some rain too in a number of the major cities. It's been like it for two or three days now. However, end of the week, it'll turn colder and some snow is expected from Chicago to Detroit right up to New England. Further south, however, the airports like JFK will be fine. It'll be mostly rain here. On to Friday's city outlook then. In Chicago, 0 degrees and snow. In Toronto, also zero with snow showers. San Francisco, a mild 18 and sunshine. In Vancouver, 7 degrees, and we can expect some light rain here. Other world locations now, rest of the week and into the weekend. In South America, Sao Paulo and Rio, thunder showers likely every day. Temperatures will hover between 28 and 30 degrees. Buenos Aires, on the other hand, a different story here. Dry and sunny each day with a high of 25. In Santiago, a little hotter, 28. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
10 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24, and you're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Well, he's been quoted as saying that Africa is the final frontier of aviation. The founder of EasyJet, Sir Stelios Hadjiwanu, is planning to launch a low-cost, no-frills airline company on the continent. FastJet, as it will be known, will link six West African countries to the capital of Ghana. The eventual plan is thought to be for the airline to cover the whole of Africa. Well, joining me in the studio to talk more about it is Monocle's foreign editor and former Nairobi correspondent, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello.
Very warm welcome. Hello. Thank you for joining us. I'm joined also on the phone now by Professor Roger Wootton. He's Programme Director of the Air Transport Management course at City University here in London and is an aviation expert. A very warm welcome to you, Professor Wootton.
Hello there.
Just basically sum up for us, Professor Wootton, what the situation in Africa in terms of its airline infrastructure is.
Well, I think basically, it is definitely in need of a efficient, low-cost and hopefully low-fare airline. And there's one example that has been developed out of Morocco, which is Air Arabia, which is modelled to some extent on the EasyJet low-cost model based in Europe. But that flies only from Casablanca and other Moroccan cities into Europe.
And why this, as it stands, only works within one country? It works within Morocco, and as you say, it's worked within the UAE. How would a low-cost airline find success across the entire continent?
Well, there's one other airline called, a strange name, of Fly 540, that is based originally in Kenya, but has other operations in Angola and in Ghana. And that is being financed by the Lonro organization and has been very successful, though it only flies small propeller-driven aircraft, a lot smaller than I think that Stelios is expecting to operate.
I think one of the interesting things about Fly 540 is when it was launched about 3 or 4 years ago now, the impact that it had on Kenya Airways. In Kenya, because Kenya Airways is one, alongside Ethiopian and South African Airlines, is one of the big three airlines in Africa, and they pretty much had a lock on, certainly on East Africa. You know, if you wanted to go anywhere, you know, from Uganda to Nairobi or to Kampala, you know, to Rwanda, you know, you had to go with Kenya Airways, really. But as soon as Fly 540 came in, they dramatically lowered the prices that Kenya Airways were flying. And it's, you know, there was a little bit of competition. So suddenly, actually, your flight from Nairobi to Juba is, you know, is $400 rather than $600 or $700.
Steve, you've had fun and games trying to get yourself across Africa,
yeah,
haven't you?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I think what was interesting, I first moved there in 2006. And even then, if you wanted to get from Nairobi to the other side of the continent, you often had to fly out of Africa first. You had to go, you know, back to Paris or Brussels or to London and then fly back in. So, you know, it's changed dramatically just over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, Kenya Airways, Ethiopian now fly, you know, all over the continent. It's possible to get to pretty much everywhere from one of those hubs.
But the fares are very expensive.
Oh, no, absolutely. You're quite right. You know, to fly from Nairobi to Freetown in Sierra Leone on the other side of the continent, you're looking at $1,300.
One of the issues as well, though, gentlemen, is that is not necessarily the fact that the airline model, the low-cost model itself is inherently a bad thing. It's actually probably incredibly good, were it not for the fact that the open skies policy doesn't necessarily, well, exist in the way that it might do in, let's say, Europe.
I think that's a key issue. And the question will be, can an airline based in Ghana really be able to serve as wide a demand as it would like, particularly since clearly the richest country in the region of West Africa is Nigeria.
And, well, Nigeria's actually got quite a number of low-cost airlines, although their problem is tends to be more about safety than price. But I think one of the other interesting things about this is it's a recognition that this sort of growing middle class in Africa isn't just the figment of economists' imagination. It really does exist, and there actually is a market for these carriers that perhaps wasn't there a decade ago.
Although there's a market, is there necessarily the accompanying infrastructure that will ensure that an airline will be able to operate efficiently and, more importantly, safely?
Possibly. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that, I mean, I think probably two-thirds of the official, of the EU's official blacklist of airlines are African. And there are certainly, enormous safety issues. And as you say, infrastructure as well. A lot of the airports in Africa simply aren't up to scratch. Jomo Kenyatta in Nairobi is a nightmare. They've been trying to rebuild it for years and for various reasons haven't. The airport in Accra isn't bad, but it's going to need a lot of investment in if something like this is really going to take off, and you're going to get a workable hub.
What would you say to that, Professor Wooten?
Well, I agree with that, and I think that the key issue is the things like maintenance of the aircraft, the air traffic control systems, the meteorological services, which have been poor, and indeed, if you look at the accidents that have occurred in Africa. It tends to be that it's the infrastructure problems that cause many of those accidents rather than the airline operation itself. And that is something that any airline operating in the region or based in the region has got to face.
There's a question there of operating and basing itself in the region, and it is believed that Ghana will be used as the main hub. What are your thoughts on the use of Ghana, Professor Wooten?
Well, I think in some respects it's excellent in the sense that it has a good reputation in terms of the infrastructure at the Accra Airport. It has a reputable civil aviation authority, and it's got a heritage of aviation, which to some extent is a result of having a president who was, as you know, Flight Lieutenant Rawlinson, who was interested in aviation.
Do you think, though, that by basing itself in Ghana rather than, let's say, the United Kingdom, there might be inherent... it might put people off? I mean, I'm not wishing to sort of decry the airline before it started.
The question will be whether they are going to be able to have aircraft that are registered and operated under the European standard of flight operations, or whether they're going to have to operate under Ghanaian rules only. And if they're under Ghanaian rules, they will suffer problems with respect to the leasing of those aircraft.
I mean, I think the thing that would be really interesting to see as this develops is how much these little pockets of low-cost airlines are going to be able to link up with each other. So you've got, hopefully Fastjet now in West Africa. You've got Fly 540, which has been incredibly successful in East Africa. You've got a number of low-cost airlines in South Africa, including Mango and Kakuma. So they've you're starting to get a bit of a network, but at the moment they're certainly sort of staying within their regions. Hopefully in 5 years' time we'll be able to say you can fly from Accra to Nairobi for $300, and that sort of thing. When you bring the price down that much, I mean, at the moment it's $700 or $800. That's when you'll really start to see changes that are quite dramatic.
And do you think that only someone from outside the continent will be able to sort of sort out the whole continent and take a large view of the thing?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think you look at what someone like Titus Nakuni, the CEO of Kenya Airways, has done there is quite astonishing. I mean, he's turned what was a really quite bad state-run airline into a privatised company that now flies to 50 destinations across the continent. When I was last living there in 2010, every month they were opening a new route. It was to Habarone, to Luanda, to Mali, to Bamako. Every month there was a new route opening, and they've And that expansion has really, you know, changed the whole game for aviation in East Africa. And hopefully, you know, if FastJet gets off the ground, it could do something similar in West Africa.
And do you think, Professor Wharton, that FastJet can also start doing what Stelios's other businesses have always done so well, which is operate spin-off things like hotels and extra transport systems?
I wouldn't like to comment on that. I think he's got to get the people moving first of all. And just as an aside, in Ghana, there is a competitor, which is Africa World Airlines, which is being financed by Chinese investment. So he's not going to have to pitch alone. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It indicates that there are other people thinking about the idea. I don't think that these airlines are necessarily going to be as well run as he envisages his to be.
Professor Wharton, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Professor Roger Wharton from City University here in London. And many thanks indeed to Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, for coming down and contributing so beautifully. Thank you very much indeed. 20 minutes past the hour here on Moriori House.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Moriori House. We turn now to the concept of democracy. It's an idea millions have aspired to, fought for, and died for. It's held aloft as the ideal method of governance. So why is it that those whose countries operate under a democratic system often seem so jaded by it? Well, a new book titled Democracy Despite Itself aims to make us all fall in love again once with the idea, even though in practice it's arguably a series of botched jobs. Well, to talk more about it, I'm joined by the political scientist Mike Edwards. He's one of the two authors of the book Democracy Despite Itself. A very warm welcome to Moriori House, Mike. You're a political scientist. You've written this book alongside Danny Oppenheimer, who is a psychologist. What brought you together to write the books? You know, what perspectives did you come from?
Well, we're very old friends, and so Danny, for a living, basically studies judgment decision making, which is how he, for a living, studies how people are pretty irrational, pretty prone to these incredibly strange biases. And so he was in my living room one day and was complaining about, like, you know, how can democracy possibly work? Because, you know, people are crazy and they don't understand what's going on and they are ignorant and all of this stuff. And I was like, you know, well, actually, democracy works really, really well. And we kind of started looking into it and looking at the data, and you'll find, looking at the data, that democracy is actually incredibly successful. And so what we were trying to look at is, well, why is that true? Why can, on the one hand, people be so irrational and ignorant, and on the other hand, have the system of government that collects all of those irrational, ignorant votes works better than just about anything else we've ever tried?
Well, you say that democracy is successful, but taking a quick glance at your book, the argument, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that idealistically democracy is sound, but procedurally it can be an absolute mess.
It can be a mess at times, but look at the alternatives. I mean, there's this great study that was done by guys named Lake and Baum back in 2000, where they looked at places like Nigeria, where democracy, you know, never took hold, but you know, within two or three, you know, within just, they've had democratic experiments, and shortly after moving to democratic experiments, all of a sudden you had expanded access to clean water, expanded access to education, expanded access to healthcare. And it's like, well, these were incredibly corrupt and failing democracies, and yet even then, even there, those kind of transitions worked. They helped. And so, you know, so it is true. It's, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the data, yeah, democracies can be pretty messed up a lot of the times, but the alternatives are so much worse.
So how do you gauge the success of a democracy? Is it, like you say, the sort of the social aspect to it, or the fact that they might, a country may be internationally more peaceable, for example?
Well, I think there are three ways that we look at it. One way is if you look at sort of the rights and liberties of citizens, and this goes back to, you know, your John Locke or your Thomas Jefferson, the, you know, the purpose of government is to promote the life, liberty, and happiness of their citizens. And in that sense, democracies are hugely successful. They promote better civil rights. They promote better welfare for their citizens. They promote better access, like we said, they promote better access to healthcare, access to education, access to all of the things that sort of make life good. You can protest, you can have, if they promote access to free religion, access to free press. I mean, on down the list. The other thing, you know, you kind of alluded to the democratic piece, and that's a thorny issue, but there is, does seem to be that if you look at the democratic, the data, you know, democracies are somewhat more peaceful vis-a-vis each other, and that, which is, again, another indication, democracies are different, and there's some fundamental ways, and so what we wanted to look at is what are those differences, and why is it different?
And when you look at the way that democracy might be peaceful, did you consider the fact that it seems to be nigh on impossible to impose a democracy on another country, such as been attempted in Iraq?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, democratic transitions generally work best when they come internally. I mean, this is true of any, in my opinion, this is true of any government transition, that external forces, it's really hard to tell other people what to think and what to believe. Like, they're going to make up their own minds. The democratic piece is very narrow. I mean, if you look at it, it just says democracies don't tend to go to war with each other. It's not about, well, democracies attack non-democracies all the time and vice versa. It's really very narrow. It's just that democracies don't go to war with each other, which, like I said, it's not so much about the peace aspect, because there are still a lot of non-democracies out there. It's more that it's an indication that there's something fundamentally different about that system of government.
What I found very interesting about one part of your book was the fact that, although you were saying there that you can't force people to vote one way or another, there are some quite absurdly charming aspects to an electorate. You had a whole chapter on irrationality, where people preferred George Bush's features in a time of war and John Kerry's physical features in a time of peace, and people are charmed by someone who has an attractive dog. I mean, it really seems rather arbitrary and haphazard.
And at times it's very arbitrary and haphazard. I mean, one of my favorite studies that my co-author has done is he can encourage people to vote to answer a questionnaire in a much more liberal fashion by putting them in a chair that is physically leaning to the left, which shouldn't matter at all, right? I mean, you know, whether you have a caster missing on your office chair shouldn't matter, shouldn't affect how you think about, you know, welfare policy, but it does. But that's kind of the crazy thing about it all. It's like, if you give people a voice and if you give people a say in their system of government, they tend to cooperate. It tends to lead towards a better society and a more stable society than if you don't, even though those people are prone to all of these strange biases.
They're also often quite ignorant of the actual facts that are determining that are driving these politicians who are placing themselves in the public eye.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of my favorite things from the book we talk about is there was a poll done a couple years ago in the United States where people thought that the United States was spending much too much money on foreign aid, and they wanted to cut the foreign aid budget of the United States from 10% of the budget from 20% of the budget to 10% of the budget. Well, the actual foreign aid budget of the United States is less than 1% of the budget. And so, you know, anyone looking at that data is like, first of all, the people don't know what they're talking about. And if you're a politician trying to follow that will, it's like, well, how do you even start? You know, does that mean you should raise foreign aid or lower it? Because they want you to lower it, but they want it to be higher than it is. So
finally, I'm afraid time is running out on us, Ed, but there's something that's always puzzled me, which is why, as you're trying to make us all fall in love with democracies again, why do people get so jaded about it? People say, well, whoever I vote for, they won't get in, it won't make any difference, I'll break our promises. People who have this great luxury don't really seem to want it.
I wouldn't say that it's not that they don't want it. I think it's more that it's very easy to feel disappointed in the choices that groups make as opposed to you as an individual. I as an individual might, I mean, you see this with choices on at the marketplace all of the time. I might prefer, you know, one kind of cereal or one kind of beer, but that's not the options I get because as a group, as a whole, that's not what the populace wants. That's, you know, everybody's personal taste is different than what the sort of mean, the sum of all the personal, all of the tastes are.
Mike, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Sorry to cut you off there. That was Mike Edwards, a political scientist and co-author of Democracy Despite Itself. It's 30 minutes past the hour here on Midori House.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
Much more to come up here on Midori House, including in the next half hour, we'll be joined by Monocle's broadcast producer Gillian DeBias and our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé to cast a glance through Monocle's film archive. But before all that, Nick Kelly has our news headlines. Nick.
Thanks, Emma. Simultaneous early morning attacks on mostly Shiite targets across Iraq killed at least 60 people and wounded dozens today in one of the bloodiest days of violence since US troops pulled out in mid-December. Syrian tanks have pushed into a rebel stronghold in the battered city of Homs, and UN investigators accuse President Assad's government of crimes against humanity. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has threatened sanctions on anyone blocking reforms intended to end Somalia's hopeless bloody conflict, as she termed it, and counter-militant and pirate groups seen as a growing menace to world security. Afghanistan wants NATO to put on public trial those who burned copies of the Quran at a NATO base after a third day of bloody protests over the incident. Iran is believed to be carrying out preparations to expand nuclear activity deep inside a mountain in a further sign of defiance in the face of intensifying Western pressure to curb its sensitive uranium enrichment drive. Mitt Romney is fighting his way back into the driver's seat in the Republican presidential race, putting in a strong debate performance in Arizona and gaining in polls against conservative rival Rick Santorum. Greece's parliament endorsed a debt swap with private bondholders today that forms the core of its €130 billion bailout, despite new protests against tough budget cuts demanded in return for the rescue deal. The White House has proposed a Bill of Rights that would give consumers greater online privacy protection and could eventually give the government greater powers to police internet firms such as Google and Facebook. The Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard has dared her political rival, the former Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd, to challenge her in a leadership vote next week, hoping to end infighting that threatens to sink the minority government and its reform agenda. And finally, we don't have much science in the news these days, so how about this? Neutrinos, which appear to have undermined a basic law of the universe by exceeding the speed of light, might have done so even faster than first thought, or might have not have done it at all. Physicists in Italy said today. Put your mind around that. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Nick, thanks very much indeed. And Nick will be back in a little under half an hour with a full roundup of the global news headlines. Time now for some music on Monocle 24. This is On Your Own by James Yule.
What to do when you're on your own?
And that was On Your Own by James Yule on Monocle 24. The time is 25 minutes to the top of the hour. And I'm happy to say that we have been enjoying our birthday week here at Monocle. We've been hearing from the editors and the creative teams who've helped shape the magazine in the past few years. Well, today we push the pen and the microphone to one side. I'm incredibly pleased to say that Monocle's broadcast producer Gillian DeBias and our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé have joined me in the studio to discuss an evolution of Monocle's films and obviously your ambitions for the future. A very warm welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Tyler, let's go back to the beginning, 5 years ago. What was the remit for putting broadcast into what was going to be a magazine?
It's probably 5.5, even 6 years ago, because when we were building the business model for the entire venture, We were looking at all of these discussions about paywalls and, you know, were we going to be putting the whole magazine up online for free? And it simply didn't make sense. I thought if you're going to be spending £5 for this, you know, the last thing you want is then for everyone else to be able to go and print out those articles. And I think we took the view that we wanted to have a quality experience when you went online. It wasn't just about the number of eyeballs that were going to the site. And, you know, then we started talking with Gillian and we just said, you know, wouldn't it be amazing that in the same attention to detail that goes into putting out the print edition, that we didn't talk in terms of videos. We always talked in terms of just of creating and commissioning great films, and also and not aggregating content from other places, but these were all things that were commissioned and crafted by us.
And we also thought, you know, we weren't going to replicate the pieces in the magazine, because there are certain things that live beautifully in print and you love the printed word, but then there are other things that actually can enhance the story and open it up a bit if you then put a camera to it and tell it in a completely different way. So certain stories lend themselves so well to film in a different way, in a complementary.
And we should probably take a step back, because Gillian was a collaborator, and we worked together a very long time. Of course, we're both part of the Canadian broadcast mafia, which is somewhat rife in this building. But that aside, we worked on two series together at the BBC. So we did a documentary series about media, which was called The Desk. And then after that, we were commissioned to work on another series called Counterculture, which looked at the whole rise of consumer culture in both established and emerging markets and across six countries. So we had already, there was already that, I think, established tradition of doing longer format, sort of very documentary style pieces. And that's what we wanted to bring to the mix with this.
Because I have noticed that when you talk about the material that you produce, you never use the word television, you never use the word news, and you never use the word, heaven forbid, the word package, which is rife among television newspapers, television and television newsrooms. You have always been very specific about the use, your use of the word films and my films. Your
And hopefully not in a pretentious way, because they're short, they're 4 minutes, they're 6 minutes, but
exactly.
They are beautifully crafted.
What marks them out from television or a package?
Well, I think we were very, very conscious that we wanted it to reflect the design aesthetic of the magazine and the ideas behind them. And to a certain extent, I wouldn't say it's retro, but it is very much about this story. And so we don't want cameras that are panning and zooming. We don't want handheld cameras that are running around really quickly. We don't want quick edits, because actually we are telling a story. It is journalistic, but we are observers and it's very much about crafting.
And I think that that's one of the things you'll note as well, is that there's an absence of presenter or editorial talent. So you hear the voice, but, you know, as much as possible, we want it to be documentary in style. So it is narrated by the subject. And it's only been in very rare instances where there's been, let's say, a Q&A format that you've ever really seen one of the editors. And that's also deliberate as well, because we haven't sort of talked about the contributors page in the magazine, but very early on we said that we wanted a certain amount of mystery around who the editors are, and it wasn't sort of about the cult of having all of these people's faces slapped in the front of the magazine. And that's why we do audio.
I think we've got an example of this, which is the telling the simplest stories. It's a story from 2009 called Daily Talk, which actually has a subject matter which makes a mockery of journalistic job titles
well,
such
everything
as production
we're doing
designer.
Now, absolutely.
It sort of blows us out of the water. Let's have a listen to what it's about, and we'll talk about it in a moment.
Alfred's day begins in the newsroom, a small wooden shed attached to the back of his blackboard. He chooses the most interesting stories from the morning's papers before updating the Daily Talk's headlines with chalk. This is a one-man show. Alfred is the news editor and reporter, the production editor and designer.
It's an incredibly charming story about a man who runs a newspaper
in
Liberia.
And did you recognise that voice? There's a very young cub reporter, our Steve Bloomfield.
Local to this parish.
Yes, very much so, when he was based in Nairobi. But, as you know, it was a great film. It was just this incredible story about this man who has, you know, nothing more than a shack at a major intersection in Monrovia in Liberia. And as Steve says, that he would go and just write, no different than being in a favourite restaurant, that he would just go and write up all the headlines for people who, of course, couldn't afford newspapers, and people just sort of gather around, and it is the most simple, brilliant concept, and it's so modern in its execution.
What I love about this one, I mean, this one was slightly different. It doesn't have quite the same production values as our other ones. But
not
the story
Steve was involved.
So, no. Just,
it doesn't seem to matter, though.
Monrovia, we couldn't get a camera, and we literally found someone with a little handheld camera. But the story was so good. And even, you know, 4 minutes of it. And that was one of the beauties where we had a number of really interesting people respond right in, and including sort of media funding agencies in Brussels, in
Absolutely.
Belgium, getting in touch with us saying, we love this concept. We want to help fund him, do not just in Monrovia, but all around Liberia. How can we get in touch with him? So we're forging these relationships. And then, you know, out of that comes, you know.
It also highlighted something that you pick up with quite a few of the sort of the focus pieces that Monocle does, which is a respectful nature of the film. With so many other news and reportage things, you think, well, what's the political or the financial agenda behind this? But this is just about a man who does a job, which is just utterly charming.
Yeah, and you know, and we had to, you know, send Steve, you know, across Africa to go and do the story. So, you know, and again, when people are crunching numbers in newsrooms, you know, everyone would have said, God, absolutely not. You know, we're not going to invest in doing a story like this. But it was, as Gillian said, it was great. We knew it would be worth the investment.
Well, let's move to the opposite end of the spectrum and your love of air shows and all things aviation.
Well, trade shows in general, I just love the absurdity of them all. So I think sometimes Gillian dreads, oh my God, what's Tyler going to come up with next? Where is he going to send me? But you know, Gillian has become almost as much an expert on aviation and defense. But now, once Gabriel Lee joined the scene, and we put up a really wonderful film today as well. So if anyone gets a chance, you must go and look at our coverage from the Singapore Air Show, which I think is just one of the best air show things that we've ever done.
And given that we break up our films, we follow the template of the magazine. We have A for Affairs, B for Business, C for Culture, D for Design, etc. So the trade shows, they fit really well in the business section, and they really are about, you know, discovering things first, finding out what the business word is on the street.
And we try to be, I mean, you know, a little bit more obscure. And of course, you know, again, many of the major rolling news organizations, you know, they might sort of dip into these fairs and they'll have, you know, a very sort of, you know, short 30-second compilation. You know, we would rather come back, and then in the case of today's film from Singapore that went up, it was a nice eight-minute piece. But again, I think we also like to find small businesses as well, or just things that are a little bit quirky and odd. And you mentioned sort of film. We did a piece on the Impossible Project, which is started or had its rebirth in the Netherlands, which is about bringing back Polaroid film. And this is a little example on the Impossible Project.
Impossible was a very appropriate name. It was really, really very, very hard. Absolutely. Actually, it was impossible, and that we managed to do it is almost a miracle. That we are able to resurrect something like that with just a small team of ordinary people, against all odds. We don't feel like heroes, and we are not, but it does make you proud.
Gillian, this is a subject that's very close to your heart, isn't it? You love this subject.
I love this subject, but also, you know, it's the kind of stories I love to tell, which are about people who are passionate about what they're doing.
And, you know, it's funny, just a few minutes ago, I don't know if you saw the delegation of very nattily dressed Japanese gentlemen who were going through the building. They were all from Beams in Tokyo, one of the big retailers, and they pulled out a camera, and they said, oh, could we take a picture? And it was a camera, a restored Polaroid camera with Impossible Project film. How's that for a seg for you,
that's
Emma?
Lovely.
Is that good?
That's brilliant. We've done this before, haven't we? Let's move on to culture then. The 53rd Venice Art Biennale is something that you flagged us up as a subject that you wanted us to have a listen to. Let's have a quick listen to how this was covered.
While the Biennale in the Giardini and Arsenale attempts to reflect the avant-garde, the now, the future, it inevitably nods to the market too. Pavilions will be bought, artists' stock will rise. The extracurricular stuff, the collateral events in palazzi, museums and converted spaces, however, give a calmer glimpse at curatorial instincts over artistic ones. Despite the greatest hits of the art market feel of Pinault's collection, it's a museum-challenging show of blue-chip newness. Elsewhere, the Wesleyan Infinitum shows allowed, amidst the chaos of the Biennale, calm consideration. While the pavilions are getting their new licks of paint, getting their bulbs changed, having their tyres kicked by the throng, the off-Broadway gems stoically stand tall. The sideshows, if that's what they are, do reflect the market and the now in a sense by saying in their subtlety and singular vision that a work of art should be for life, not just for the summer. In Venice, for Monocle, I'm Robert Bound.
Robert Bowne casting his very poetic feeling all over the Viennese.
It's just so beautiful listening to it.
And that's what I love. It really is. As much as the pictures and as much as we craft the cinematography, it's also very much about the script. And
Rob's good at his script.
He has this wonderful turn of phrase. I think he mentions a dizzying ton of art at the beginning of that piece. And what you get is sort of an almost onslaught of words and pictures that come at you, which is unusual, actually, in television. Often they just let the pictures go or just let the words go. But in certain cases on the Monocle pieces, you get the lot.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. You don't know where to go, and it's quite exciting.
It's almost like we do writing for a living, isn't it?
You'd never get it. I always hope so.
Goodness.
Writing and pictures, too. It's quite amazing. What was wonderful about that piece when I noticed it was it was the combination of the location, which is always so dear to Monocle's heart, and the fact that they had the for example, there was a Palestinian exhibition inside a convent.
Yeah.
So you had this deeply Italian sense, but also this incredibly strong political sense, which is what sort of Monocle always tries to look at, the slight quirk.
Well, what we love about the Biennale is the whole notion of the national pavilions as well. Mm. And so you have the history of the national pavilions, whether it's art or whether it's architecture. And every year, the same countries take over the same pavilions, but they reinvent them. So it's so rich with ideas, and it's about politics, and it's about countries, and it's about nation branding, and it's about art or architecture, and it makes very good films.
Mm.
Now, another thing that you wanted to talk to us about was the Vienna apprenticeships, which is something that our design editor Hugo McDonald did just last year. This was part of the time when you did this for Bloomberg, didn't you?
Yes, so we had a six-part series that we did on Bloomberg Television.
So this is when big television meets crafted Monocle.
Exactly.
What happened?
Oh, you have to. We'll talk about it over drinks sometime.
Okay. No, I was actually talking about.
We're talking about the film.
No, I was talking about the film.
Not our Bloomberg experience.
That wasn't what I was asking. Yeah, okay. But thank you for the answer.
You're welcome.
But tell us about the Vienna apprenticeship.
Again, we're always keen on looking at. Yeah, in this case, not just the issue of youth unemployment all over Europe, and that was, I think, a very hot topic at the time, but also, you know, looking at that notion of craft and why is it that when your builders come from Germany or Austria or Switzerland, they know how to put a screw in the wall, and you know, a lot of it has to do with the culture of apprenticeships, and we wanted to look at what was being done within the city of Vienna, but also the way the Austrian, you know, Ministry for Labor also treats young people, and they have that notion that not everyone needs to have a BA after their name.
And the focus is coming back to old values as well.
Absolutely.
Let's have a listen to this.
The confectioner Demmel has been baking cakes since 1786. Quality is key, and keeping a staff rigorously trained is how the quality is maintained.
The apprenticeship is 3 years. In the first year, they have to go into school 1.5 day, and the rest of the week they have 2 days off, and the rest they have to work here in the demo, in the bakery, on 8 different pastry stations. We have the cookie station, you have the strudel station, you have the preparing station for biscuits, pong and sacher, you have also the decorate station, and you have also the chocolaterie. The maximum what we can have apprentices is nine people to give a guarantee to make a really good apprenticeship.
Oh, to work in a place with a strudel station.
Can we have one here, Tom?
I know. You've got the cookie station and the strudel station.
Now, you see, I'm picking up something here, Gillian, that when you dispatch your reporters, you generally send them somewhere nice. But you managed to go somewhere nice yourself, didn't you? You went to Istanbul.
Well, no, you
went to Lebanon.
But it's a segue in from the strudel station. Our food films do extraordinarily well, not just for the producers and directors who get to go, but they're very, very popular. So I did, we'll take a listen. I headed to Lebanon to do a story called Kamal's Table, a recipe for Lebanon.
Well, you know, life cannot be but freeform. When one listens to really his own heart and instinct, it's jazz music, it is freeform writing, it is just looking what you have as ingredients and combining them together. When you're writing, you're combining words, or you're combining notes for music, or you're combining ingredients for food. So it's always how to listen to one's own instinct and heart and do the best you can of what you're doing. In Islam, they say every act is an act of adoration. If I'm preparing a calamar now, I'm not just preparing lunch. I'm just trying to do the best of some things that I have, of a calamar, of a bit of tomato, of coriander. It's the best I can. You know, it's not the best ever. It's the best possible I can.
clearly someone else who gets incredibly passionate about their trade.
Poetry in a kitchen.
Absolutely. Gillian, one person who I do see by getting very passionate about their trade is you, Gillian, because you've had to deal with these clod-hopping idiots from radio coming in and taking away your broadcast.
I do like radio, but they have stole a bit of my oxygen, so I'm fighting back with more films.
Tyler, give this lady reassurance that there will always be a broadcast side to the magazine.
There definitely will, and you know, Gillian should be careful what you wish for, because we had a very good planning session for something foodie, a little bit of a project we've got up our sleeve, which can live in audio, but it also definitely needs to be in film as well.
So where does this go next, and where does film go next?
Well, I mean, we've got a lot of things coming up. We've just been shooting in Australia, down in Sheep Station Land, which of course ties in with our Australian theme in the current issue. The Geneva Auto Show is coming up, so again, we always have a lot of trade fairs. The one that we didn't touch on, though, and I think they're quite moving, is also some of the slideshows we've done, and Sophie's going to be doing one on our, we have a big Sami story in the next issue, and still one of my favorites is when Fiona did the Fuji Kindergarten, which is one of the most beautiful slideshows.
And what we do here is we really use the best possible photographs, that some of which have been in the magazines, but many often don't make the pages of the magazines. So we open them up a bit. We have the correspondent tell the kind of backstory, and we just really linger on a great script and fabulous photography.
Well, long may it continue. Thank you very much indeed, Tyler and Gillian. You'll both be staying with us, I hope, in the studio to look through issues 31 to 40 of Monocle. So do stay with us. It's 8 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
We turn from television now to the printed word. Every day on Midori House, we're picking our favourite articles from past copies of Monocle. Today we have the meaty issue of the whole of Year 4 to get through, ladies and gentlemen. So to help us, we have Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief. Gillian DeBias is still with us, and our editor Andrew Tuck has joined us. And you've got all the magazines, Andrew.
Well, I've got quite a few of them, but I see that Gillian and Tyler's got a fair share as well.
We were in here
My
first.
My pile's just as big as yours.
So we're looking at Year 4. Mm. When was Year 4? What was Monocle doing in Year 4?
Well, we start in March 2010. It's issue 31. And we didn't recognise it at the time, but it was something of a controversial cover. And the cover line is, who are you going to call? Rescue, recovery and rebuilding. This is why the world needs a more agile approach to disaster relief. So we're also looking at how nations, you know, of course, you know, at, you know, in an era of hard power, of course, how people send in the troops. But this is also how our country is able to use relief forces in a soft power way. And Israeli is a different element of diplomacy. And we put on Israel's National Search and Rescue Unit. We shot them at the Ramla military base in Israel. What we didn't think about at the time was our readership across the rest of the Middle East.
I was about to say, and, putting Israel on the front cover is going to provoke a reaction.
Yeah, so this meant that many copies were just binned. But in some markets as well, they didn't mind the cover so much, but then it was actually the cover on the inside, and they just, and we, as we found with the authorities in Lebanon, they let the magazine go, but then they just go and, with not even Tippex, they've got this mm-hmm. sort of special sort of black kind of almost foil that they just go and cover up all the stories, and someone has to do that every single issue.
So what do they cover up? Just the
Israeli? They just cover the Israeli story.
Fine. But literally any mention of Israel. Yeah. It could be a nice cultural story as well. They have someone whose job is cut out a bit of tinfoil and stick it onto the story.
Right, okay. And right. How often have you gone and covered the Israeli air rescue force since then? Yeah, that's a lesson learned.
it was one of those ones going, oh, your distributors in the Middle East are saying, we're sort of wondering about that cover. Anyway, it's a handsome, it's a nice one nonetheless. So that kicked things off.
Andrew, what came up next?
Well, I'm not completely going to be running through in the right order here, but jumping to May 2010, we did an incredible trip to Rio, and afterwards I headed on up to Brasilia. And this was an amazing story for me
tough
to do.
Tough gig.
Yeah, it was a tough gig. But we arrived in Brasilia, and it was a story about Brazil's kind of power in the diplomatic scene and why its embassies were suddenly around the world, the places everyone wanted to go and visit. But we kind of embedded for 2 days inside the foreign ministry, and It was amazing.
That must have been a really tough gig. Yeah. Really, it's getting hard. It's getting trickier the more you talk about
it. But what's fascinating is an Oscar Niemeyer building. It's been untouched. There's been some slight changes, but you realise how few enemies Brazil has in the world when you arrive at the front desk and there is no glass wall, there's no barriers. There's a tiny little turnstile that you could jump over in 1 second. And after day one, when they gave me the pass, they didn't even bother checking. They just like waved me through. And after 2 days, we were wandering around the Itamaraty Palace, meeting diplomats, meeting the people kind of forming Brazil's place in the world. And it was an amazing, amazing gig.
That makes a journalist's life 10 times easier, doesn't it? And it sort of warms the cockles occasionally.
Yeah, and it was also just great that they were building new alliances with South Africa, with other BRIC nations. And we just got to meet all these people who were trying to represent Brazil in a new way.
Kyla, what else did you pick up?
Well, and just also that cover that goes down as actually one of, I think, still one of our best-selling covers.
Describe it to us for those who don't have a copy.
It's someone who works in health and safety would hate it, but it's this wonderful swooping staircase at the Itamaraty Palace, which is the foreign ministry. So it's just this wonderful modernist swooping staircase, and this one female diplomat sort of running up the stairs. But what's incredible about the swooping staircase is that there are no banisters, and I mean it's just wonderful, Oscar Niemeyer modernism at its very best. But oddly, there's no eye contact. It sort of breaks every cover rule. But I think because it's incredibly graphic, though. And I think it was something quite ghost-like about it as well.
Gillian, wouldn't you agree it has a sort of an absolutely graphic element to it that seems unreal?
Yeah.
You don't actually think it's a real staircase?
No, that would be the kind of imagery we'd look for with our camera. Yeah. We would. And in fact, I'm going to highlight another...
That's the alarm bell, I think, that they're telling.
Are we on fire?
I think we are on fire. Okay. We're definitely on fire.
Can we not be on fire for the next 2 minutes? No, we'll be fine.
All right, I just want to flag shortly issue 36. It was when Daniela Pele did a lovely story for us on Afghan social marketing, really looking at how you convince your people to really love their army. But it really touched on much more about really small scale sort of printing and getting messages out on the most handmade ways, which we then turned into a film for Bloomberg.
Hmm.
Anything else, Andrew? Very briefly, well,
you were looking for the flames, weren't you?
No, I wasn't.
I want to just do this one very quickly because we don't always get it right. And I see that Sasha Isenberg in September 2010, he tipped Dominic Strauss-Kahn saying he would be the man who would run against Sarkozy.
Right.
Something else happened in New York in the intervening period.
Yeah, exactly.
Which we should gloss over. Well, thank you very much indeed, Tyler, Andrew and Gillian, for coming
in. Thank you.
Giving us a recap of year four. We're out of time for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. The show is produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Andrew Carter. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time. Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will be discussing the perils and pitfalls of operating businesses in India. From all of us, though, goodbye.